us more.
John, Paul, Ringo, and George. What did Ken learn from each of the Beatles? In this episode, you'll hear Ken's last encounter with each of the guys. Wait until you hear his story about the day John Lennon died.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles!
Hello and welcome to The Beatles, The Bible, and Beyond. I'm Brian Mason.
Hi, I'm Ken Mansfield, and I was lucky enough to be handpicked by the Beatles to be their first U.S. manager of their new record company, Apple Records.
Join us as we talk about the intersection of Jesus and music while sharing incredible stories from Ken's days in the music industry.
This is The Beatles, The Bible, and Beyond.
Ken, just out of curiosity, because the Beatles were known as a quote-unquote spiritual group, as far as what we knew the word spirituality and such meant in the 60s. Maybe not as what we know as Christians, as followers of Jesus now. We would argue with what we knew maybe back then. For example, was there any discussion about God or Jesus at all? Of course, you weren't a believer in those days, but did you ever hear a discussion about Jesus?
No, the word never came up as part of a conversation that any of us sponsored on our own. I don't ever remember any conversations about that. And I think I remember if somebody from the outside that was trying to witness to us and to the Beatles, if the word was brought up, that it was brushed off rather abruptly, and it just wasn't something that was in anything we ever discussed. Now, you do have the thing with George and the Maharishi, which happened around that time, and that was the Beatles agreeing to go on a spiritual journey with George, because he invited them all in, and they all went to see the Maharishi together, and it was kind of interesting, because George was committed. George was truly seeking God in his way. But the other guys, they went along with it, and they did the whole thing, and there was some kind of cool things about it, but just one by one, they all drifted away from that, and it wasn't a part of their lives or something that they shared with George after the experience, I guess you would call it.
Right. And it seemed to happen at a particular time, too. In fact, it was immediately after Brian Epstein died that this took place. In fact, didn't they find out that Epstein died while they were on this trip?
Yeah, I think so. You know, they were very good people. You know, people kind of think that I'm painting this picture of the Beatles when I talk about them. But all I ever did see was really good things. I didn't see the bad things. I'm not saying that there were not bad things. It's just something that I was graced with the fact that I have nothing except pleasant memories of the time. Even when John was, you know, ragging on me pretty hard, I have no scandal stories. When I was first approached about writing a book, they didn't want to hear my story because they wanted dirt. They wanted, you know.
How so?
They just wanted me to tell things that were naughty, I guess.
They did?
Well, yeah. They wanted these books to sell, and they wanted to have some expose in there, you know. And I've got these tender little stories about George Harrison putting me to bed when I was tired, you know. It just wasn't what they were looking for.
Right, right. And wasn't there a conversation about you and Ringo and you saying about writing a book, or Ringo telling you to write a book? And he said, oh, just do what everybody else does and just make stuff up.
I didn't have a number on Ringo, and he was in Rockabella, his place in Monte Carlo. So I called Bruce Grickel, his attorney, and told him I wanted to talk to Ringo. And Ringo called back the next day. And I had an idea that for an album project with him. Now, this is a time in Ringo's life when he was really at a bottom. I mean, he had made some terrible records. He did this thing with Chips Moman, which was a nightmare. I don't know. He just was really in a bad place.
Not a good time.
Yeah. And so when Ringo called, I told him I had an idea for an album with him. And he said, well, this is perfect timing, Ken, because I am not signed to anybody on anything right now. I'm totally 100% free to do something that appeals to me. So I talked to him about doing an album project. And he said, well, I'm going to be in L.A. in a couple of weeks. Would you be any chance be there too? And so I said, well, I hadn't planned on it, but I'm doing some mixes on a Flying Burrito Brother project that I was doing. I said, I'll just mix them in L.A. and come in during that time, and no problem. So we met for dinner. It was at a Beverly Hills restaurant in the Beverly Hillcrest Hotel, I think it was, where I was staying, and it was a restaurant that he liked. Bruce Gerkel came along. And we hadn't seen each other for a few years because we left town together, both of us, I mean, really messed up. And that's when he went to, I believe, the Betty Ford Clinic. And I just went up north to Mendocino to my place up on the ocean just for a while. And we both just cleaned up and got straightened out. So anyway, it had been maybe 3 years since we'd seen each other. And so when we walked in the hotel and we just were looking at each other, see what we looked like, you know, because I think he weighed about 97 pounds when last time I saw him or something. It was pretty bad. So it was really a nice get-together. And he told me, he said, you know, I have become everything that I used to hate. He said, I couldn't stand these kind of people. He said, but now, you know, I don't drink, I don't smoke, you know, I play golf or something, or I work, you know. Right. He said, all these things I used to make fun of people and wonder what was wrong with them, why they weren't partying and stuff. As the conversation went on, we talked about the idea of doing an album with really great musicians. And he said, well, this is totally it. He said, the reason that the Beatles were famous, there's a single reason, he said, is we were a good band. He said, that's the heart of everything with the Beatles. We were a good band. So he said, I like the idea of putting together a bunch of really great musicians, but instead of four people, there's going to be a bunch of us. And the idea of maybe having three or four producers on the album so we can do different things with different producers to get different flavors on the album. That was the conversation, the agreement for him to do this album and for me to represent him on it and go look for a record deal for him. So I worked out my particulars with Bruce Gerkel. And during the conversation that night, he said, so when are you going to write your book? And I told him, I said, I've had offers, but I don't have any dirt on you guys. You know, I don't really have things that are kind of scurrilous,
yeah, right.
You know, like that. And they're just not interested. And he said, well, why don't you just make stuff up? He said, that's what all the others have done, you know, and kind of wink, wink. But what it was him telling me that he trusted me to write about them. And,
wow.
And
that was the relationship.
That was the nature of the feeling, and when he said that, and it was like very many, many years later before I decided to do that. And when I did it, I decided to play it by the book with the Beatles because they never asked us. They knew that we were going to see things and know things, and they never asked any of us, well, okay, if you're going to be in here and see private things, you can't say anything about it.
You never signed an NDA,
yeah,
non-disclosure. You never did anything
like
that.
The odd thing is, had such a feeling of being honored to be invited in that none of us really did tell things. It was just like it would be betraying, being given a special privilege of being someplace and then betraying it. Of course, Peter Brown wrote that book, which I really felt bad about his slant on the Beatles because it was a dark slant. When Gerkel presented the book, because I said I was going to play it by the numbers, and they had to approve it. When he presented it to them, he presented it to everybody.
The book was The Beatles,
The Bible, and Bodega Bay.
Yeah.
And he presented it to the current managers and the attorneys and the board of directors and the Beatles themselves.
Right.
And got everybody's approval. But the thing that was interesting is Ringo said to me, Ken, I give this book my blessing.
Interesting.
Now, that's not the kind of terminology and language Ringo and I had with each other. It was a little bit more of a rock and roll, mm-hmm, you know, dialogue.
Yeah, okay,
so,
with me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm a Christian now, and I'm thinking, you know.
Wow.
With him. And then later on, because I was helping him find material for the album, and I sent him this one song that was basically about, no, I don't do this anymore,
right,
or something.
Another song,
yeah. He sent me a demo that he did of it from England. He had put this kind of a long tag on it. It was before rap time, and it was kind of like a rap type, mm-hmm, attitude as the music was fading. He said, well, what'd you think of the tag on it? And I said, well, I just didn't really listen to the words because it was a tag, you know. Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, well, listen to it. And so I listened to it, and it was like almost like praying, oh, Lord, because his message was, you know, not to do drugs anymore.
Yeah.
And
I used to do this stuff, but I don't do this stuff anymore.
Yeah, don't do it anymore. Yeah. And it was kind of like, oh, Lord, you know, I can't remember the words, but he had those kind of words in it.
Wow.
And so I thought this was the second signal that Ringo had sent my way. I never made any progress in that area with Ringo. I just thought that thing was in him. I thought that thing was in Paul, because mm-hmm. Paul was not a Christian, but Paul did Christian things. And now that maybe people won't like me saying that, but it was just, he lived his life. You know, in the atmosphere we were in, he was a kind person. He was
respectful person.
Respectful. So I just thought, this guy's automatic. He's just kind of already there, and now somebody just needs to present the Lord to him.
How did your relationship, I mean, all these years later, because after being gone from Apple, I know you've encountered, let's stick with Paul. You've encountered Paul a time or two since the Apple days. And again, you maintained an unofficial liaison for a time or two. You helped sneak him into the country, and you helped, you know, do this and do that, even though you weren't officially working for him, just as a friendship kind of a thing. But in more recent years, and I'm saying since 2000, have you encountered Paul?
Let's talk about the last time that I saw each of the Beatles had any contact.
Yeah.
Paul was such an intense day-to-day relationship. You know, he was like a co-executive, as I said before. But when Apple was over, contact with Paul didn't maintain as much because I was someplace else with another job, and he had his job, and I had all the Beatles' phone numbers, and from the beginning, that was Ron Cass's way of showing me, we trust you, I'm giving you everybody's home phone number. But Paul and I dropped out of communication just kind of naturally with the evolution of time and evolution of where we were in our lives. A few years later, he came out for the Grammys. I didn't have any contact with his people then, so I didn't know how to get a hold of him. But after the Grammys, went out to the parking lot, and Paul was in the parking lot trying to get into his car, and there were all these people around him. And I'm standing back like 20 or 30 feet, and I just yelled out, Paul. I tried to do it so maybe he'd recognize my voice. Mm-hmm. And Linda Eastman, his wife, she turns around, and she goes, oh my gosh, Bloody Mansfield, you know, get over here, you know. And so I go over and we talk, and he said, well, look, this is crazy. And whoever was running the show with him at that time, Paul said, give him the phone number where we are tomorrow so we can get together. And so they give me a phone number. So I call the next day and I say, hi, this is Ken Mansfield. And some 17, 18, 19-year-old girl answers the phone. And I said, I'd like to talk to Paul. And she said, well, that's not going to be possible.
You and every other person.
Yeah. And I said, no, I said, he asked me. I said, I've got this phone number. I said, he asked me to give him a call so we could get together. She said, well, I'm sorry. He's just not available. She was just sloughing me off regardless, you know.
Wow.
I just got thinking later, gosh, this kid is not letting us talk to each other because we hadn't seen each other for a long time. And I know that we were all looking forward to it. I mean, it wasn't like, oh, I'm get some time with a Beatle. It was just, let's catch up with each other. And Linda, you know, was part of our relationship and everything. That's and sad. She would not. I said, well, look it, just tell him I called. And she said, well, thank you very much. Goodbye, and hung up on me. So that was...
Wow.
The parking lot was the end of our relationship. Now, what's interesting about that, over the years, he has sent messages to me where people have got to go backstage afterwards type thing or something and knew me and ask about it. And, hey, tell Ken this, or how's he doing, or whatever. So that's been a lie, but we just haven't.
But it's not the same.
It's the same because it never changed. You know, we've gone our separate ways and we're...
But you've got handwritten notes that he's written you on a plane.
Oh, yeah.
And just, in that sense, it's not the same of
And I'm not calls. I'm not a collector. I don't save things. But the things I have with me and the Beatles, which are in my books, are things that just did not get thrown away.
Right.
They weren't things I was saving, but
right.
That was interesting on that. With George, that was a relationship that went on for really a long time. During my MGM years, during my CBS Barnaby years, we were getting together on things like on the Bangladesh concert, you know, where he invited...
The concert for Bangladesh.
Yes.
August of 1971, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, that's when I was president of CBS Barnaby, Andy Williams' label.
Yeah.
Of course, this isn't the last time I saw him, but
right.
Just talking about how the relationships did go on for a long time. Andy Williams and I are having dinner one night.
In L.A.?
In L.A. Mm-hmm. at this French restaurant. We were having a pretty good time. And so he said, oh, I see the concert for Bangladesh is tomorrow. Let's go. Now, of course, that was in New York,
right.
Madison Square Garden.
Right.
And I said, well, okay. And he said, well, hey, big man, you were with the Beatles. Set us up. Get us seats. So I get up. And it hasn't been that long, you know, so I still had almost everybody's numbers or a contact on everybody. And in those days, I go back to the payphone between the restrooms. And I can't get a hold of Alan Klein, the manager. I can't get a hold of Paul, Ringo. I couldn't get anybody to do with the Beatles. And I came back and I said, Andy, I can't find anybody. And he goes, oh, my gosh, what am I going to do with you? And he gets up, comes back 10 minutes later and says, we've got great seats.
Andy Williams got you seats.
Yeah. And I said, oh, what do you mean we have great seats for the concert tomorrow? He said, well, I called Teddy Kennedy. And Teddy called Charles Bluedorn, who owned Madison Square Garden.
Oh, my.
And Charles got us some good seats. So,
oh, my. Wow.
The next day, we're up and we're on a plane to New York to see the concert. And we are in the hotel suite. And I had gotten through to George that I was coming in. And George said, call me at this hotel where I'm at and tell them that I've told you to put you through, and I'll give the address where we're going to have a big dinner thing and a big get-together afterwards. We're in the hotel suite, and Andy Williams came out of a group called the Williams Brothers, and there were four in the brothers, and Dick Williams was just this hoot. He was a character, the funniest guy in the world, and he was up in the room. And so I call the hotel, and I said, George Harrison, please. And she said, well, who is this? I said, Ken Mansfield, he's expecting my call. And she said, well, I don't see you on any list. I said, well, just ring the room and tell him I'm on the phone, and if he doesn't want to talk to me, he won't talk to me. She said, no, I'm not going to be bothering him. If your name's on the list, you know, I'll ring through. So here we go again, you know. And Dick Williams, he said, here, let me take care of this. And George had been doing something with Cary Grant, some kind of thing for about a cologne or I don't know what it was.
Right.
It could have been tires. I don't know.
Right.
So Dick calls the hotel and he said, hello, this is Cary Grant. Could I want to speak to my old friend, George. Is he there? And she put him right through.
That's a lousy Cary Grant, by the way.
No,
but it's okay. We got the
thanks
point.
Thanks a lot, yeah.
But she put him through?
He put him through.
But apparently your Cary Grant's good enough. You got through in the story.
No, his Cary Grant was good enough. My Cary Grant. Anyway, so George gives us the address of the party afterwards, and it's an Italian restaurant on the east side. You go down into this place. It was a very famous Italian restaurant, and he had reserved it for the evening.
Oh, wow.
So Andy and I walk in, and Phil Spector's on stage, and he's, I don't know what he's doing up there. He's emceeing, or he's playing on the piano, or he's doing something. He was just out of it, just really smashed on something, and he was just weird. And he saw Andy Williams walk in, and he goes, oh, there's Andy Williams. Hey, Andy, come on up here, Andy. Let's do a song. Andy did not like the fact of being called out in the crowd. He just wanted to be, you know, anonymous. But Phil wouldn't stop. Now, one thing about Andy Williams is Andy Williams never did anything on the Natch. When he sang, it was with sheet music. It was his piano player, I mean,
right.
His orchestra, whatever. And Phil Spector would not leave us alone about Andy coming up. And so finally, Andy said, I'm out of here.
And so, you were out of here too.
Oh, yeah. And there was all these really neat people there and stuff.
That's sad.
As time went on, George and Patty and me and my wife, we were just couples, and we would do things. And then, like, after Bangladesh, George went in the studio, and, of course, everything was supposed to be live, but there was just some stuff in his vocal that he didn't like and some guitar stuff. So we spent just a few days of him at the A&M studio, just him cleaning up things, wanting to keep it live sounding.
So when you're saying that, during the recording of the live concert, he would maybe tweak a few things. So
yeah, well, there'd be a clam on the guitar or part of his vocal he didn't like. And so he was having to recreate this and keep the live feeling. So I wasn't producing George. It was a matter of him saying to me, what did I think about? And then, of course, people would drift in and out, so you'd get to meet more famous people all the time. Sure. But it was just this kind of thing where we just had this natural relationship, and as couples, too, it was comfortable. The last time I saw him was years later, and the restaurant next to the Troubadour, Mario's or something, I forget what the name of it was, there was a thin alley that went between the two buildings, and he was now married to Olivia. Me and my wife had left dinner and were coming down this narrow alley, and he and Olivia were coming in, and we stopped in that space and chatted for a while and said, let's get together, and then we just didn't. And that was the last time I was face to face with him.
How did George's death affect you?
One thing that preceded that, and this is this thing about, you know, if your mom's on your mind, you should call your mom. Or if you've had an old friendship that you've let die, but you people met a lot, give them a call, keep in touch. You've got something to share. And this was one of these things that when he was ill, he was at his place at Hana up in Hawaii. He had this state or this big place up there. And I was in Hawaii for a week or something, vacationing, and I thought, I don't have a number, but maybe we should just rent a car and drive up to the hill to Hana and just hope he's there and or hope he'll, you know, see me. And I didn't do it, you know. And it's just one of those things to where I should have done. But it was all good. It was all good. It was just maybe because he did pass away not that long afterwards, and it would have been nice. Ringo and I went on, well, we still do, forever, because he moved to L.A. early. He became part of the scene there, and he and I shared the same attorney for years, and like the thing with Dolly, and just hanging out. It was a real natural thing. We came out of the Apple thing. We came through our lives falling apart. We came through new marriages, and all these things were just, you know, all our bad boy era periods and everything. And it's an ongoing relationship. The only difference now is Ringo, and I've talked to a lot of people, that he's kind of pulled back, and he's not accessible to hardly any of us anymore. And it's funny because just in casual conversation with Chris O'Dell or something, you know, there's not many of us still alive.
Chris O'Dell was American that worked at Apple Records.
She was at Apple Records, and she was Peter Asher's assistant.
Right.
And she lives in Tucson now, and we're in touch with each other. And Jack Oliver, who actually was the last president of Apple, even though it's not that well known because that's when everything had fallen apart. But he lives in L.A., and he said that Ringo's kind of shut him out too. So none of us can kind of quite figure that out because Ringo's out there. He's very active.
He's still touring, yeah.
Yeah, I guess he's just kind of separated. But wow, I have so many memories with Ringo. I mean, my gosh, we did so much.
Do you expect to run into him again?
Well, I still got to work off those things about he blessed my book and made this little prayer at the end. But anyway, once again, it's all good.
Yeah.
It's all good.
Yeah.
John Lennon, that leaves one.
Yeah.
I was in L.A., and I had taken on a new house. I moved out of a hangover house and taken on this beautiful house that overlooked the whole city. You could see from all across Century City, L.A., you could see the San Gabriel Mountains. You could actually see Catalina. I mean, this house was just marvelous. I had just moved in, and it had a studio in it. It was Donald Byrd's house, the famous jazz musician. Hmm. And it had a recording studio in it, and then an office so that you could sit in your office and look at a window and see what was going on in the studio. So it was a very well thought out thing for like a jazz musician to work on things and also observe what's going on in the studio or whatever. I'd been there about 3 months, and I thought, you know what? I got everything, all my memorabilia and all my stuff from the old days and pictures to hang up on the wall and awards and stuff like that. I've got them all stuffed up in these cabinets. Maybe today I'm going to start putting stuff on the walls of my office. So I opened the thing and I pull out a box. I don't even know what it is. And it's a box from my Apple days. And it falls on the floor and breaks open. And kind of the breaks open and pictures and stuff and all that just were kind of spread out in front of me, like maybe like a 6 feet wide type thing. And there's a picture that John Lennon had sent me. I've got it in some of my books, but it was a thing he sent to me and said, I'm at 3 Savile Row most days. And it was one of those pictures that where the eyes follow you. You know, you've seen those pictures on the wall, no matter where you go, sure. Look, eyes following. And I'm looking right in that picture. And
on the
phone,
floor.
On the floor. Yeah. I'm on my knees on the floor. And the phone rings. And now I'm producing Nick Gilder at the time, who had a big hit with Hot Child in the City. And he was a real famous Canadian artist. And to be honest, the reason I think he hired me as a producer, because I knew John Lennon. I mean, you know, and he was a giant John Lennon fan. So anyway, the phone rings, and I answer, and there's just this sobbing and noises or words I couldn't understand. I finally ascertained that it was Nick. And I said, well, Nick, just call me back, because I can't understand what's going on. He said, okay. So 3 minutes later, he calls back, and he said, John just got shot. I got the phone to my ear, and I'm looking at this picture of John Lennon looking up at me.
Oh, my.
And I said, Nick, I'll call you back. And I got the phone, I looked at that, and I started crying. And I realized the strangest thing came over me. It didn't matter that I knew John Lennon, that I'd worked with John Lennon, anything like that. I pulled back entirely from all that and joined everybody else that was suffering that loss at that time. I became part of the mass of people that were moved by this thing and realized that I had no right to any personal sadness. This was a universal sadness. And that it affected people. You didn't have to have known John to be moved by the loss, you know that. And something that hit me that not a lot of people talked about, but not only did we lose John and his personality and his creativity and the future music and all the things that were going to happen, the idea which everybody had and knew was going to happen, that the Beatles would reunite someday, even if it was 30 years later or something, that was something everybody was looking for. And it couldn't be Julian Lennon because he looked so much like John. It's not like I'll replace a guitar player in the band. There was no replacement for John in that band. I hadn't seen him for years. He's one of the Beatles. When it was over at Apple, it was over. No more contact, you know. But Ringo's a giant country music fan, and he was a giant Waylon Jennings fan, and I was Waylon's producer. And I had just gotten back from Nashville finishing the Are You Ready for the Country album. And he knew I was there, and I was doing the album, and I had the master tapes with me. So he called, and he said, okay, I want to first listen on this, so will you bring the tapes over, and I want to hear the album. On my way there, John Lennon shows up. And this was during the lost years.
Right.
And so I walk in, invited to Ringo's house to share an album. And John was sitting on the couch, and he was did not look
not
at me like, oh, hey, Ken, great to see you. It was like I went from being an invited person to an intruder. Because what was happening, John really wanted to, had something he really wanted to talk to Ringo about, and
didn't chew around.
And it was not, you know, my timing. It was just bad timing. It wasn't my timing. I stayed a little while and knew it was time for me to excuse myself. But I had a situation that was gone down with Jesse Coulter, Waylon's wife, the artist that I was having number one records with.
Yeah.
We recorded Hey Jude, and we called it Hey Dude. And I had to get permission, I guess it was from Sony, to make that single word change in the whole thing. Or when you, of course, a couple other words because it was a female.
Right.
And Sony Records said, we will give you permission, but you will need permission from three of the four Beatles.
Oh, wow.
Now, come on, because they knew that nobody could hardly do that. Well, here that day, I'm with two Beatles.
Two out of three.
I got two out of three.
Yeah.
Of course, Ringo said yes.
Sure.
But I actually got John Lennon's approval if I would leave. You know? I mean, I'm shortcutting it, but that's really what it was. Yeah, okay, I approve.
Right.
Well, now I've got two Beatles, and I don't remember if I got George or Paul, but I mean, I was home free on that. Sony Music just couldn't believe that I just, okay, you want three? Here's three for you. But that was the last time I saw John, and it was okay.
Yeah.
You know, at least I did get to see him again.
Yeah. Ken, you spent a ton of time with the Beatles. You had to have picked up something. You had to learn something from each one of them. What would you say you learned from each one of the individual Beatles?
Well, John was, in his way, the most dynamic of them, and his dynamic came from a lot of times from his silence, from his cynicism, his inaccessibility, his willingness to just go against the flow of things, to follow his dreams. And so I think from John I learned that you don't have to always go with the crowd. You know, you've got to quit being a people pleaser, because he accomplished so much in his short lifetime just from doing and being himself. So I think maybe I spent the less amount of time with John face to face. I think I may have walked away with the most impression on me personally, my character. Because when I met Waylon Jennings then, I had this part of me that, boy, being an outlaw, you know, which John was a rock and roll outlaw, was kind of comfortable because you didn't have to explain yourself anymore. You just did what you did, you know. And people expected us to be like that. That's what they liked about the outlaws. It was like living through us things that they wouldn't do. So I think John gave me a part of my character in that I quit worrying about people, and I was willing to resign from the corporate companies eventually and just go on my own with nothing guaranteed. I just had the guts to do that.
At the same time, did you learn things from John that you went, I'm not picking that habit up?
Well, yeah, there was that's a good thing. There was a lot of that in there because a lot of it was offensive to people. So it was just drawing out of the potpourri of things that John Lennon was and picking that one thing, which was really a major part of his character, was that. And then you come to Paul, which imagine these two being so close and so different. Because Paul was a people person. And I saw from Paul how he immediately engaged people around him. Like, even if you've seen some of the pictures when they're driving by these screaming crowds where Paul would roll down the window and wave and smile at him, you know. He had this thing where he would engage people and was always on a light, kind of a happy way that he did things. And that was more close to my natural character. So I saw, as I had certain levels of success, that I liked the way Paul treated everybody. And so I found that I like people thinking I like them and in the process, having to like them in order to pretend like I'm liking them. Mm-hmm. And it became something to where I really was open to everybody and just wanted to have people be happy to be around me and to be happy to be something that was good for them. It was a word in a word. It was like a goodness that I admired in Paul.
Right.
Okay, Ringo.
What did you learn from Ringo?
What did I learn from Ringo? I learned, and I think it's something that worked for me and worked against me, but I learned English sarcasm. And that was just a natural thing. So I'm always saying something to somebody that I'm ragging on them a little bit and thinking they think it's funny and they don't think it's so funny. And, you know, so, I mean, Ringo would say these things. Well, like, I want to give you an example on this. When I told Ringo that I was mentioning a while ago in one of our conversations that I didn't really have a lot of bad stories about the Beatles. I didn't have any naughty stories, you know. Is I just saw them as good people. And so when I write my books and stuff, I write about this aspect that I saw the Beatles all the time. People kind of go, well, you're kind of sweet-cutting this band, you know, all the time. But I told Ringo this at dinner one night. You know, I said, I always had the feeling when you guys hired me and brought me over that you wanted to impress me. And so that you were always on time for things, and I was never included. If you guys were off doing something naughty,
right,
or whatever, that I was never included, and I was never
told about.
I was always hidden from me. So I always had this feeling that you were playing me in that way, trying to impress me, so that I would be more excited about running your company because you were such good guys, you know. And Ringo was just looking at me the whole time with his head kind of cocked aside and went, oh, yeah, Ken. As a Beatles, we never really had a lot to do, so we would really spend most of our time sitting around thinking how we were going to impress you, you know.
Pleasing Ken is all we think about.
And there was something about that that I loved English sarcasm. And I do it way too often before realizing where people are at. But I took that away from Ringo, other than the fact that he really enjoyed life. And he did give me a sense of that. And we were very free form in our time together, especially when he moved to L.A. But it was just that lighthearted approach he had to everything, you know. I'm describing, these are little pieces that you pick up from individuals.
But you end up picking these pieces up and applying them.
Yeah, they become a part.
Yeah, they become a
part
of you. I
think part of it because they were so famous that they were things that were powerful in their personalities. You know, and that's why I say the Beatles wouldn't have been the Beatles unless it was those four people, because there was something so dynamic about each one of them. You put four of them together, and you had four parts of a puzzle that created this one entity that appealed to everybody somewhere in that band.
But maybe when you throw a little of the British sarcasm out in your life now and then, you think about Ringo, right?
Maybe. I do. Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe I even mimic him at times,
maybe.
You know, because
maybe
there was a rhythm to his sarcasm.
Yeah.
And the way he would lay it on you was really kind of...
All right.
It was almost a put down, you know, anyway.
How did George impact you?
George, I think, was the person that I identified with the most. And I think the deep searching for God in him and the kindness was something that out of all the exciting things with, let's say, the other Beatles, that was the thing that I identified with the most, me as a person. Which had probably a lot to do with how simply I grew up as a country boy and how I was taught so much about manners and courtesy and things like that, and to be respectful of your elders or whatever it was, you know, and to say yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, and all these things. Now, these are countrified things, but with George, this respect for fellow man had taken all those things that I was taught as rules and laws, brought them into a personal place, and I was able to meld them as an adult, and they became a mature part of my personality because of George, because of the way he acted. When I talked about him telling me about becoming a New Ager, that he wasn't preaching to me, if he would have done that, I wouldn't have been listening to his words. What happened to me later on, it was his essence, for lack of a better word, and that was a gentleness and a kindness. I think of all things, that would be what I would want as a central thing in me, you know, to be like George. Now, George, you know, wasn't perfect as the years went on, but there was that part of him that just I admired and wanted to be part of me so much. That was the overriding thing that I learned. I think he affected me the most, and I think the time we spent together was the most memorable. Like when he was remastering the White Album, to be included in that, he just told me, he said, when we did the album, he said it was too much, and I just want to redo it. And he included me in just being there while he went against everybody.
I was going to say, it wasn't really his job.
It wasn't his job. And he was in L.A., and we were doing the Jackie Lomax tour.
But he took the time to.
And he took the time. He heard the masters. And he said, no, this is not good. And so he said the whole project was just so overwhelming that he, in his own peace, wanted to smooth it all out.
And was the remastering that he did what we ended up hearing?
Yes, as far as I know.
Wow.
Because the masters were made there.
They were made and sent over, and yeah, that's what he heard. Yeah, yeah. That's what he wow. So,
yeah. There was just that thing about George that I've never seen quite to that length than anybody else, you know.
Thanks for joining us. We appreciate you not only being a part of this season, but also this tribute to our friend, Ken Mansfield. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode of Ken's incredible stories.